Bill 2240. Mr. Britton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2240 involves the regulation of certain kinds of child care facilities by the Employment Department. Now, within the Employment Department, there is the Child Care Division, and they are the ones who are responsible for implementing the statutes related to child care regulation in the state of Oregon. House Bill 2240 requires the Child Care Division of the Employment Department to inspect child care facilities if the division receives a serious complaint about the facility. And the agency, through this bill, would be able to define serious complaints through, through its administrative rules. It also directs other state agencies to notify the division about child care facility complaints. Now, at the risk of being wrong, let me describe the fact that the child care division has different categories of facilities that it regulates. There are some facilities, and I call them facilities, they may not exactly be that at all, who are exempt from any kind of regulation. There are also those who serve more than roughly 10 children that are regulated today with annual inspections of the facilities, and the child care division has the authority to go in and do what it needs to do in these centers. This bill involves kind of the intermediate group of facilities, those that serve children that serve 3 but no more than 10 children. Many of them are located in homes. So heretofore, this group of facilities has had what I'm terming semi-regulation. They are registered at the child care division. The child care division does monitor somewhat the activity of those facilities, but it does not conduct annual inspections. It doesn't right now conduct an inspection when somebody registers to be a family child care center. This bill would allow the child care division, as I said earlier, to investigate serious complaints. Now, another important thing about this bill is the fact that the money associated with this bill, the fiscal impact, and I've given you a copy of the fiscal impact statement, is about $506,000 in the upcoming biennium. The fiscal support to undertake these activities is already in the Employment Department's budget, and that budget has passed both houses and is before the governor for signature. So the passage of this bill will not create a problem in terms of the department's budget. And with that, I would turn it back to you, Madam Chair.
Could we have him explain the reason it's not going to cost anything?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Ross, it will cost something, but what I'm saying is that the federal funds are already in the Employment Department's budget. This bill was anticipated when we worked that budget.
So it's not an addition to their budget or a disruption of the already active funds.
Madam Chair, Representative Ross, that's correct.
Thank you.
Any other questions, Council? Okay. Ms. Crosley?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Verena Crosley, the Director for Employment Department, and I have with me Annette Talbot, our legislative coordinator. Our state committee staff has done an excellent job of telling you about the bill. One point that Representative Ross had asked about the amount of that package or the portion for this particular bill is around $505,897, and it would fund 4 positions to do complaint investigations. I don't have anything else other than to say that this package is a high priority in the attempt to get better quality in the area of safety for child care in Oregon. This is a particular area that has not been well financed in the past, And with additional federal funds, we have the opportunity to do some things we've not been able to do before, and it is already in our budget. Thank you.
Any comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of questions. Could you just give us a little more background as to what's driving the need to get at these complaints? I mean, what's sort of the history of the complaints in Oregon, and then maybe a little more background about who is exempt from investigation and who is not?
If I can't answer, I'll ask Annette to help me out. But generally speaking, there are two major areas that we deal with in the child care division within the department. One is group homes and child care centers, which are the larger types of businesses for child care. There's about 1,200 of those, and they take care of about 60% of children in paid child care. And then there are those that are considered registered. Under Oregon's law, currently, those are called registration without inspection, and those are for individuals who care for children that have about between 4 and 10 children. If you are under 4 children, or if you take care of your family's children, for example, then you are exempt from child care. Those are generally the categories. And that may have some that I haven't thought about, but those are generally speaking the categories.
My second question, which one is about the complaints themselves?
Madam Chair and Representative Edwards, the actual complaints have been ongoing in this particular area, but we don't have as much authority to go in and actually follow up. We do if it's a serious complaint in family child care facilities or in homes, but we don't have as clear authority as we do in centers. Those we actually do unannounced visits, and we actually do annual checkups to basically see if they're okay. And then if they do have a serious complaint, we do go out on those. But in home care, whether it's between that 4 and 10 children, we don't have that same type of authority. The types of complaints that we get range from over numbers, for example, children in the home are over the 10, so sometimes 14 or more oftentimes, and that's a serious complaint in that they're not well cared for in that instance. But we've had much more serious. Some have been in the paper just fairly recently where hitting children, for example, is another type of serious complaint. And some of them range just, you know, where a person doesn't pay their bill and there's a complaint filed that is unfounded. But there are all types of ranges. The more serious ones, we try to go out on probably about 10% now. But this particular package would allow us to go out in about 50%.
Madam Chair. If I might, Annette Talbot, Legislative Coordinator for the Employment Department. In response to Representative Edwards' question as well, the Child Care Division has never actually received funding for complaint investigators for purposes of family child care. So this would be the first time we would actually have dedicated staff for that purpose. We've sort of siphoned off the certifiers, staff who do centers and group homes to come over and to respond to serious complaints in the family child care area because we haven't had any staff. So this will be the one time that we're able to actually dedicate these 4 FTE, and that's why we got the package before with the extra federal funding.
Last question about the federal funds. Is this a one-time federal fund, or are we?
Mr. Chair and Representative Edwards, we don't know. It is additional dollars that's been made available, but they have not told us whether it's going to be continuing. So in our budget, they've actually made that a pilot, and it's basically because of the potential that federal funding did not be there.
Senator Gordon?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and good morning. I really appreciate the work that the division, the department has put into this particular initiative, but I am very troubled at what I see coming down the road. The legislators are going to have to prepare to act in a manner that we're not preparing for yet, in my view. What I mean by that is House Bill 2240 requires the department to respond to all complaints. That's what the language says. But the package is only giving you funding for 4 FTE and is allowing you to respond to 50% of the complaints. Isn't that correct?
Madam Chair, and Brenda Gorlick,
and that is not good enough. That's not adequate. And I know that you're only responding to the funds that are going to be available to you, and those are federal dollars. But that does not take care of the problem. It does not nail down the issue in front of us. And so that's our challenge, Madam Chair, is to look beyond the session and to the interim and beyond, and how we're going to take care of these kids. And that's what we're talking about. We're talking about children who are in serious jeopardy in many instances, and we don't have a plan for how we're going to respond beyond this bill and this package.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Gorlick's comments, of those 1,200 complaints received in the biennium, are they, in your view, basically valid? You would consider them to be serious and valid? And
Mr. Chair and Representative Backlund, we do, of the ones that we investigate, most of them are valid. But the ones that aren't, we make a notification in our files that they have not been substantiated. But generally speaking, there is some truth definitely to the complaint.
Mm-hmm. Follow up, Madam Chair. Of the 1,200 complaints received, let me go back a step. Family child care homes, how many are there? If there are 1,200 complaints, what percentage of the total number is that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Ackland, I think we have about 10,000 in-home care providers that have children between the 4 and the 10 children. So about 10,000 of them. And of the number of complaints, I actually think that the 1,200 that I was using was the actual number of certified providers. The actual complaints that we got was about 532 against the registered family child providers. And we received 1,312 complaint allegations.
Mm-hmm. Other questions?
One other follow-up, please. If this bill passes, do you anticipate that it will have any impact on the numbers of family child care homes? Will that discourage some people from providing that service?
Mr. Chair, I'm Representative Backlund. It is a potential that it could if they do not feel that they would be allowed to continue in business, but that's one that we would probably not want to be providing child care as well.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning.
Good morning.
As you know, I'm very pleased that you're here.
Thank you.
And like Senator Woodley, I think only taking half a loaf, although we're just starting on that, it's been long overdue in our state of addressing this particular issue. I came from the years when we talked 4C, when we talked about comprehensive daycare, and so I was a little taken back when I came back over these halls to find that we had not moved forward in the 20 years that I left this building. But having said that, I noted that we're only one of 6 states that do not conduct periodic inspection, and is it the plan of the division that next biennium to come forward to talk about some full funding in this particular issue?
Madam Chair and Representative Winters, the answer is absolutely yes. This is a very high priority for the department, and we're very fortunate that we have federal funds that allow us to do some things that we've not been able to do. But the Child Care Commission and the Employment Department continually hear about this need, and so we will definitely make that a part of our budget development as we go into next session.
Is there any match involved with the federal dollars, or is it 100% federal dollars?
Madam Chair and Representative Winters, there is a match in the child care grant. The child care division does not receive any of those. Those mostly go to the Department of Human Resources for actual care. But in this particular portion, there is not federal match that we would be using for these purposes.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Fisher?
Would you state those facts again about the complaints as they come in, about how many of them were toward the registered facilities already and how many of them were toward the unregistered, and the amount of the difference registered and unregistered?
Madam Chair, Senator Fischer, the numbers that I have with me is that we received 1,312 complaint allegations against 532 registered family child care providers, and then 112 non-registered providers.
So, 112 complaints against non-registered providers,
correct,
and there's estimated 10,000 of them?
Correct.
Madam Chair?
Senator?
I would say the unregistered ones are doing 10 times the job that the registered ones are doing. I have some serious problems with this, and I'm not against some forms of control and some forms of checking up on things, but as Representative Backlund mentioned, we try to keep the cost down on these things and keep it as reasonable as possible, and given the responsibility of people to take care of their kids and know what's going on. And I get a little leery about making things to the point where people are not going to want to be involved, or they're going to be asked to do such ridiculous things that they're not going to want to comply to the extent.
Madam Chair, Senator Fischer, we do struggle with that, of balancing what we call the trilemma, the quality and safety issues with the cost and accessibility, and that is something that we always look to. We do find, however, that this session, that the majority of the provider groups are very supportive of the 2240 and 2241, which has already passed both houses and is on its way to the governor. So we are sensitive to that. One of the reasons why 2240 is before this body is because we don't have very clear authority in regards to looking at whether someone's operating illegally. So this would actually give us additional authority to clarify that, so we can make sure that people are going to be operating within the basic health and safety standards. And the standards are very basic. We look to whether or not there's over number of children, whether they have caps on the electrical plugs. They're not, they do not rise to the level of inspections that centers and group homes have, just for that purpose, so that they can be affordable.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. Senator Johnson.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I am here to support this bill, and I did chair the subcommittee during the interim, and then Senator Leonard, Representative Leonard, served on that committee, and I wish you folks would have had the time, and I know you don't at this time, to preview the Channel 6 expose that was done on this particular subject. And I can tell you, as we sat there, each member of our committee was no doubt in our mind, this is a problem. It's a major problem. And we recognized that we did not solve the problem. We started the movement to get some notice that, folks, things have to change out there in the whole area of child care. Now, we want to be sure that there's not an indictment of the great providers out there of child care. But there are some sad, scary stories. And, we could say, well, the buyer beware, and the parents should be doing certain things, but in fact, we found that's not the case. And I guess if you look at it from the standpoint of a responsibility that we have to young children, this is a very necessary movement. And I concur, as Representative Winters and Senator Gorty were saying, this probably is just maybe a tip of the iceberg that we're getting into, but it's better than nothing, and I certainly would support movement forward. It would really—I would love to see on-spot surprise inspections, because I think that would be necessary. And I believe Representative Percy does have some amendments coming that, if funds were available, that would authorize that and conduct on-site reviews for existing providers. Right now, you're moving just catching the new people coming in. But it really, as I said, came to our subcommittee, and then we went to the full committee. It was a unanimous vote of support for this whole concept. And I guess I would encourage you folks to move forward with this, recognizing that I would hope they would come back, even during the interim. I hope we can continue looking at it and come back and move forward in this whole area. And I'd be happy to respond to any questions. I have my experts on the side here, too, that need any help.
Madam Chair.
Senator Fisher.
I'd just be curious, Senator, did the TV channel follow up any of these kids and see how the daycare that they were getting differed from their home life?
Mr. Chair, I'd have to, that discussion didn't come up, but maybe it did, but I wouldn't be a bit surprised if in some cases their home life is bad too. I realize that possibility, but I guess maybe for a few hours of the day, maybe we could make some difference.
Yeah,
it is a sad commentary on the treatment of young children in the state. And I'd say in this state, I'm sure it's other places too, but it is metal.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Good morning, Senator.
Good morning. Good morning.
I'm pleased to hear you reference the Channel 6 expose. I recall watching that series, and it was very troubling. And troubling because of our failure to respond. I'm going to say that again, because we are taking a step, but again, it's not enough. And so we need to be focused on how we're going to fund investigations at the level that we take care of the problem, all of the problems that may be out there. I recall getting a phone call from the reporter who did the investigation, asking, now that he's done a report, what should he do with the information? How should he get it in the hands of legislators? And I said, send a videotape to every legislator. And as far as I know, that was done. So I hope that anyone within my listening voice, any of my colleagues within my listening voice in the Capitol who's not seen their copy of the videotape will do that. And if they don't have a copy, get one from Channel 6. I don't recall the reporter's name, but the information is just so compelling. And, again, it's our responsibility to act.
Representative Edwards?
Thank you. Thank you, Senator, for coming today. And really, and the work that you did in the interim, I think this is more of a statement, maybe you can comment on this as well, which is there's sort of two aspects of child care that I see. One is obviously giving some security both to parents looking for child care, which I think is, and the health of the children, which is combined. And as a parent, and who has used child care, it's a very comforting fact to know that you have a good care provider, and those that are bad should be out of the business, pure and simple. But the other issue, which I think is totally related to this, and that is the amount of child care out there. I think, I'm not sure what your comment led to, but I was interpreting that there is a shortage out there. There's a lot of families that have to have child care, and perhaps there's not as much choice. There's many choices for folks, both either because of their income level or just there are not that many services available, and so hence you rely on other families to take care of your families. That may or may not be something that's good or bad, but I think often you're forced maybe not make or have available places to go that you may or may not want to be involved in. I don't know if that was your comment, but I see that as another big problem, which is supplies down, or there's not a big enough supply, then you're going to have problems, more problems, because you maybe can get away with things that you wouldn't necessarily have to. There's a huge market for it, I think I know that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's just an observation, and anything you want to comment on that?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Edwards, I have to be very honest. That particular part was not the focus, you know, looking at the whole child care business. I think we were looking at the abuses. But indirectly, that became a concern. And I heard some comment earlier that we might be scaring some people out of being in the child care business. And folks, if we frighten some of these people out that we were looking at, so be it. I'd be happy to see them not be in the business at all. And I think we've had some, and I don't, there are no final decision made, but I think we've had some recent news stories that tell us this still exists, even when they try to do something and then they keep popping back up. And I think we need to put more teeth into all this. The whole area of child care, let's face it, we're in, that's our society now. Child care is very much a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I look at my own educational background, we recognize that everything that's happening at those early stages, you know, the first 18 months that many of these youngsters are in child care, that makes a difference in their whole life.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess if you want to look at it from an economic standpoint and forget the humanitarian side of it, it's just darn good economics to be concerned about all of the early intervention kinds of programs we can be. And I see this as one of the early intervention ones. And I know you get into this business of meddling and, you know, you leave it to the family and so forth. But I guess I say it goes beyond that. There is a duty of care to young people. And we're talking about young people who can't make choices for themselves at this stage of the game. And as I said, if you see the film, and it's real, it's an eye opener for you. Really, it's frightening. And I guess I would hope that we could take a long range look at this whole area, because it does need to be discussed and answer some of the questions you've raised.
Representative Burns?
Thanks, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator, for coming and serving in the interim and bringing this back before. As you were talking, the first thing I thought about was that we make surprise inspections for OSHA and other activities that we want to protect the public from. And here we're sitting talking about protecting children, you know, who are the most vulnerable in our society. And I personally want to thank you for bringing this to us.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Madam Chair, I might just comment that with all due respect, I really appreciate the House version. Senate Bill 109 really was much more inclusive and had more money available and so forth in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess we were realists and wanting to at least get some movement in this, and that's why we were supporting it to move forward with the House version of it. We want to get it started because I don't want to lose the concept at all, so I certainly would appreciate any support this group could give this bill. And I might just comment, we did, there was no referral to Ways and Means from our committee, even our CR 109 and maybe even with this bill, because the Department of Economic Development did have funds in their budget already.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why there was no, that's why we didn't, we were not trying to bypass you, we just didn't refer it at that point.
Thank you, Senator. Any other questions?
Thank you very much for your
attention. Representative Pat, would you like to come on up and work your way in?
Thank you, Chairman. As members of the committee, for the record, I'm State Representative Rob Package. I represent House District 50, which is the city of Medford. I'm also a member of the Oregon Commission for Child Care. I come before you today as someone who heard about this bill in committee. I sat on the committee that approved the Employment Department budget here in Ways and Means, and I've testified twice on behalf of this bill. Unfortunately, it's weaved its way down to you on an unfortunate referral, and I would urge you to support this bill. As you know, this bill will require the Child Care Division to respond to serious complaints on child care businesses and allows the child care serious complaints to be defined administratively. This bill will also ensure that the Child Care Division receives notification of all child care complaints received by other state agencies and any subsequent action that the agency may take in regards to the complaint. I just wanted to share with you from a personal standpoint, coming out of a prosecutor's office in Medford that got a lot of news coverage statewide, the unfortunate death of Trey Chase, who was at a child care facility. There had been some previous complaints, is my understanding. Well, we can't say that something like this wouldn't have prevented his unfortunate and untimely death. What I can say is child care is very important across the state of Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
I have an interest in the Commission for Child Care. As an expectant father, I'm interested in where this is going to go in the future, and the money is there in the Employment Department budget. We put that there as a Ways and Means subcommittee, and I'm just here to urge you to move this forward to the Senate so that we can get this approved, and I'd be here to answer any questions.
Representative
Representative Ball.
Representative Happy, thank you for being here, and thank you for this interest in this issue, and I share your concern. If the federal money does run out, the legislature will be faced with whether to backfill this or not, and that's always a difficult controversy for us. So are you aware of what kind of efforts they're going to make to get the data over the period of this financing so that when it comes back they'll have information about whether this was successful or not?
Well, I think that we're just going to have to look at the amount of complaints and the seriousness of the investigations as we move forward, and I think that that's something we need to continue to ask for as a legislature in terms of the effectiveness of the program and the effectiveness of the policies that we pass in terms of financing it. These monies have continued to come in over a very long period of time from the federal government, is my understanding. We're just using these in a different way in terms of how we're funding this program. These are additional funds that have come in under this program. That's why we're choosing to use them for the child care.
And so from your research and the information you've gathered, you expect these funds to continue and to be available for this level of inspection?
Well, as with anything in the federal government, I don't know, but at least for some period of time, and you know, like all programs, we're going to have to look at one point or another. We may have to modify or change change funding streams at some point in the equation, but this is not something that I view as a one-time cost for this particular point in time.
Thank you.
Yes, Madam Chair. I admit I'm not as up to date on some of the definitions as I probably ought to be, or should be, as in at least the former operator and instigator of the child care facility. What are we using as a definition of a child care facility?
I think the definition is very carefully woven. I would actually ask Senator Fisher to refer that to a little bit more.
Wendy Willett, for the record, the Executive Officer of the Oregon Commission for Child Care. Senator Fisher, I think in regards to what you're talking about in family child care, we define that as an in-home provider, a small business. He or she can care for children between 4 and 10 children in their home. And specifically, House Bill 2240 is referring to all child care facilities. We also have certified child care facilities. We have group homes and centers which receive inspections. Family child care do not.
Okay. I guess what I'm trying to find out is if my wife and I find someone, a neighbor or a friend or whatever, that we want to babysit our kids, that becomes child care facility.
Senator Fishing, Madam Chair. Family child care, you have to care for 4 or more children. If you have a neighbor down the street who is caring for children from only one family or caring for less than 4 children, they would not fall under the registration guidelines.
No, it's 4 children or more.
Over 3 is the way they define it. So 4.
Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Dave Barenberg, a volunteer member of the Child Care Commission appointed by the Senate President and the local government. But just to amplify through the chair for Senator Fisher, that answer, if it's more than 4 kids from a single family, then they're exempt also. It's only for 3 or more. But I like to say 3 1/4 kids. But from more than one family, and there are also stipulations as to, you know, there's limits. I shouldn't say limits. There's a threshold of how many days during a year. It's not just for Christmas vacation or other times. So it's people who do it essentially year round as a job or a profession, rather than somebody who does it as a favor for a neighbor or, you know, to fill in gaps in the school year or something like that. So it's more defined to catch people who do it as their profession.
Okay. So the number is really irrelevant. If somebody can take care of 6 members of one family, they cannot take, I guess, these are some of the things that I have a hard time with the government. It's good for one family, it's good for other families, or sometimes harder.
Madam Chair, what I just quickly wanted to say was the commission held over the last 2 years 10 hearings around the state in, you know, Coos Bay and Roseburg, all around. And what we heard uniformly from providers and parents was, and especially even more strongly from providers, is they wanted an effective way of investigating complaints. One provider testified in our Roseburg hearing that a disgruntled parent, filed a complaint saying that there was a loaded gun and alcohol in use in the home. And what they received a few weeks later because of the non-availability of resources was a letter saying, we have this report, if that's the case, please don't do it. And the provider was sort of shocked and offended, saying, gee, it was not the case in my house, in our home, but we would have liked it investigated. You know, it shouldn't be left undone, and right now there aren't the resources to do it. And right now there's a false sense of security the parents have because family child care are registered, which means that you fill out a form, a background check is done, you have a minimal requirement for one class, and then you can get your registration and proceed. And many parents think that the registration is like a license, is like a state imprimatur saying that this is fine, approved by the state, when in effect no one from the state has ever been out to see the facility, so it gives a false sense of security. So the commission felt really strong. Most of the people appointed to the commission by the president, the speaker, or the governor get on there because they care about the quality issues in child care, but are really appalled at the low-level threshold of ensuring safety for kids, and so that's why this has become the priority for the commission. Before we can assure, you know, just base-level safety, before we can move on to some of the critical issues of quality. And what we also found is most child care providers are caring and want to be professionalized, care about this, make a life determination that this is what they want to do, and, you know, want to have a system where that's assured for all. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. That means we're closed to the hearing on Council 2240. Open the work session on Council 2240. Mr. Britton.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I have no recommendation on Council 2240 other than to make a motion and proceed from there.
Madam Chair, I have
no modifications or amendments that have been presented or that we're considering.
Madam Chair, I'd move Council 2240 to the full Ways and Means of the due pass recommendation.
Representative Leonard moves House Bill 2240 to the full Ways and Means of the due pass recommendation. Is that what Representative Leonard?
Yes.
You say due pass?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Any discussion?
I think this is an important thing to do, and I think that this is a good compromise in terms of starting at a responsible level without having a huge expenditure of money taken away from other important child protection issues. And I do hope that the department gathers information and keeps track of what happens with the program, because sometimes we start things at a small level, we don't keep the data. And so I'm hoping that the department will, in fact, I've seen kids nodding in the back, and I'm all down the record that as we start this, we'll keep information up.
Any further questions?
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair. I would just like to also note, as a part of my support for the bill, that there is a Oregon strategy for social support, which was initiated through the governor's office. And one of the recommendations in that strategy concerns affordable and available child care. The concern that the governor has, and that a bipartisan group of legislators working with the governor has, are that we improve the quality and safety of child care, that we initiate inspections of family homes and improve the inspections of center-based care, that we initiate training programs for family child care providers, ensure that providers receive background criminal checks, and improve the responsiveness to complaints. So the concerns through the social support strategy are focused on all of these issues. There are several other bills that have been moving through the session. Senate Bill 109 was that Senator Duncan referred to, was focused on inspection. Senate Bill 110 had to do with family-based centers. Senate Bill 870 focused on brain development and making sure that child care providers understand the latest research and findings around brain development and how that can impact the services they're providing. Senate Bill 921 was focused on provider training. House Bill 2240, the bill before us, was focused on inspection. 2241, on-site review, and House Bill 2242, registration. So my point is to say that there's a package of child care bills in the session, and we just need to make sure that we act on all of them to do what Representative Winters has suggested, which is to move forward. So with that said, I support 2240 and look forward to voting for it.
Any objections to House Bill 2240? Seeing none, motion carries. Representative Edwards, being carried on the floor.
Yes.
No, you don't need them. We've already been on
the
floor.
We
want to carry it to full, Representative
Sure.
And Senator Gordon, would you like to carry it in? Right. Thank you very much. With that, we'll open the hearing on Senate Bill 587. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee. The measure before you is the A engrossed version of Senate Bill 587. It comes to you from the Senate Committee on Business and Consumer Affairs. They recommend passage as it is A engrossed. The measure also has a fiscal impact statement attached. I have provided you attached to the staff measure summary from the Senate Committee is a fiscal impact statement. It is marked revised as the measure was considered by the Senate Committee. The fiscal impact statement had a larger sum attached to it. However, the Department of Consumer and Business Services Building Codes Division has revised the numbers downward. We do anticipate, however, that the measure, which creates a program for licensure of third-party inspections and plan reviews, would cause them increased expenditures, which are not currently budgeted for, of $147,106 for the 1999-01 biennium, and the position requirements of program technician 2 and an office specialist 2 for 1.25 FTE for the next biennium. The program, as I say, would create a new licensing structure for third-party services to be provided. The measure also contains some direction on fee charges that can be created, a schedule that the department would create, one of which actually it's a two-prong approach. One of the fee schedules would apply to the maximum allowable fees if the department or a municipality provides those plan review and inspection services. As you recall, the statewide building code system is that the local jurisdictions may opt to provide inspection and plan review services. The Department of Consumer and Business Services is the default location for those services if the local jurisdictions opt not to provide them. With that,
Just a question to Adrian. Local government, my guess is, would want to provide these services, but I'm wondering, is there a fiscal impact upon local government to do that? And is that part of your analysis?
Well,
Madam Chair, and Senator Cho, I do refer to the potential that the local governments have reported for purposes of the impact statement that there would be or could be an effect on them insofar as the maximum fee schedule is concerned. If, for instance, the fees that are set by the department are insufficient for the jurisdiction to meet its actual cost, then the jurisdiction would have insufficient funds to perform the services. They would either have to seek some other revenue source within their jurisdiction that's authorized, or perhaps opt out of the program. And there is a representative from League of Oregon Cities here to speak to that question.
Well, is it your assessment that that could indeed happen, and that local government will be overburdened by this, or is it something that needs to handle?
Mr. Chair and Senator Cho, I don't know that I can characterize what level of burden it would have on each jurisdiction, which currently provides some portion of the building code services that would vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lee Beyer, State Senator from Lane County. 587 is a bill that we spent a considerable amount of time in the Senate Business Committee and realized that there will be further amendments should it get to the House. In fact, we've agreed to some of those. The intent of 587 was to try and do really three things. One was to put in place a system, sort of a relief valve, wherein if we had some expectations on turnaround times, on plan review and inspections, if because of fluctuations in the marketplace, local governments were not staffed up to do that, it allowed a way out. It allowed a, where they would say to a developer, we can't meet your timelines, then the developer would have a chance to go to somebody else who's licensed by the state to do that. The second thing was to try and include in the...
Who would that be? Where would they get somebody who's licensed, the local government wouldn't provide the service?
The logical place where you would get that, there are a lot of these people who formerly work for local government. That's, I think, the primary source that cities contract with now, cities or counties. There's some of those around. Others would be licensed architects or engineers who had gone to the department and passed muster.
You allow them to apply the structure and get this.
Right. Right. These would be people who met the same certification standards that the department now requires of people working for local governments or the state. So there's no difference in the standards of who these people would be. They would have to have the same knowledge and experience of the building codes that people who would go to work for another public entity would. And there are a number now. I would use as a parallel, Senator Cho, that it's a system that's currently in place in the manufactured housing industry. That's an industry that's entirely checked by people licensed or actually certified by the state who work in the factories and the private inspectors, the independent of the companies, or in the other, I'm trying to think of the other word there, manufactured commercial buildings, modular, thank you. Modular commercial buildings or housing, similar process that's there. They use the independents, but they're monitored by the state building code agencies. That was one. That the second part was trying to deal with trying to standardize the interpretation functions right now. I think that if you go back to 1973 when the state decided to adopt the building code, the idea was you'd have one code administered by the state, either through the state agency or through agents of the state, being the local governments, who would have the option to become an agent of the state and do that. This is sometimes I think it's confused when you look at building codes as the idea that there's this local option and flexibility. That's really not true. Local governments, when they're providing building safety services, are really acting as agents of the state. They have no power to change the code. They're only an interpreter of the code, interpreter and the administrator of the code. They're acting as the state's agent in that case. So it's different than many other services, and I think sometimes for those who are not familiar with the building process, that's an issue that gets confused. And frankly, in my opinion, the state has done a rather poor job on fulfilling its responsibility and maintaining consistency through the state. So that was the second piece. That's really the core of it. There are other things that were in there, but it's dealing with some of the changes. And I think Senator Crow, in some of his opening questions to staff, was getting at one of the issues, and that's in the past, the building codes implementation process in many communities was subsidized. I can tell you from my experience as a city council in Springfield for 6 years, one of the things that we did was we subsidized it. Over half of the money that was the cost of the program was paid out of property taxes. Well, in the aftermath of Measure 5 and Measure 47 to 50, that doesn't happen much anymore. You essentially have a user-driven system through a pay system, and that probably makes sense that you would have that now. But the issue, I think, for many of the builders and designers in trying to get projects underway, and this is particularly true in the industrial sectors, when they're starting out, they need a turnaround time, and they need a commitment. If they're pouring concrete at 8 o'clock at night, they need the ability to have somebody there, and often that works in conflict with local standards of 9 to 5. It just doesn't work as well. So we need a relief pressure to do that. Currently under law, local governments have the ability to contract with third parties or private parties, let's just say private parties, to do their work for them. One of the problems that many local governments have encountered, in my area, the city of Eugene, had to reach out to Santa Rosa, California, to try and find someone to do some of that work for them. It's just not as much of a proliferation of local people doing that. And frankly, another piece of that is the requirement to do the contracting is rather burdensome under the contracts law that we have in Oregon. It's a smaller issue in this, but one of the things that we did do is say that a local government, should they choose to use a licensed, an Oregon licensed inspector or plans reviewer, could choose anybody off the list of licensed individuals that the department maintains without having to go through further burdensome bidding processes, so it makes it easier for them. So, in the end result, what we got down to here is a system where really those local governments that choose to operate the system as an agent of the state have really three options. One, in their plans that they submit to the state under Senate Bill 35 that was passed in, I believe, the 95 session, they would state if they couldn't meet the turnaround times that we set as a goal in the act, they would state what those are and negotiate those with the department. And then if they could not meet those, the options with either adding more staff, which is probably not an option, contracting themselves with another party to serve as a relief valve, or just merely saying to the applicant, we can't meet your turnaround times, you have the right to go someplace else to do that, to another licensed individual. So that's the essence of the system, to provide that. I think it instills a little bit of competitiveness into the process. It puts a little bit of, sort of a governor on the system so that fees don't get out of hand, and it puts a little bit of pressure on timelines to do that. I will say that this the original concept that we started out with, frankly, was a parallel private system. Obviously, that wasn't acceptable to a lot of people, so we've done a lot of negotiating. We've had a work group that's met 5 or 6 times and has come up with a number of changes to the bill. In fact, even the Angles version that you have, we have a commitment. I have a commitment. The committee has a commitment that some of those issues that we've arrived at consensus on will have to be changed as the process proceeds to the House. That's an understanding that we have. But we were trying to expedite it out of the committee to get it out of the Senate so that the House could work on it, although it's kind of stopped a while down here. So. That's my comments. If I could answer any questions, I'd be happy to do that.
Kind of that they would have to go to the city first. Is that first?
Yeah.
Go to the city. And then if the city can't meet the timeline, does the city give them a list of inspectors, or the city refers them to a certain
The city would make available to them the list of state licensed inspectors, and in discussions that the department has had with the work group, we talked about putting that list on the internet so people could find out who it was. But one that's finished and still comes back to the city, so the city would be collecting the fee, if you will, and the surcharge that supports the department's administration of that. But it's still in the, it's totally in control of the city if it's a city or the county if it's a county.
And does the city negotiate the contract with the independent inspectors? Do they determine how much they're paid?
No.
How is that?
No, the idea was that if they couldn't fulfill it, that the contractor would go out and negotiate whatever fee that was. Part of that you have to understand is if they're coming and says, we have a quick turnaround time, and you go out to a private engineering company, for example, that's licensed by the state, and if the contract, the developer is saying, I need really quick turnaround, and I'm willing to pay your staff to work around the clock to get this done quickly, well, there's going to be a cost of doing that. And that may exceed what your normal cost, so that's negotiable. Although that payment under the amendments that we've agreed to would go back to the city in terms of the contractor would invoice the city, and the city would collect the fee and the surcharge and then would pay the contractor. So you have a little bit of a control over it. There were some of the cities and the counties were concerned that via direct payment that you may have a tendency to develop sweetheart deals, and this is a way to try and address that a little bit.
And the city would retain part of the fee to pay the bank for the paperwork and administrating?
Yes.
How much did it get to keep?
What did we get to do?
The current language,
for the bank.
We started the Ann Gross version. The intent that we were dealing with is that the cities would negotiate in their plan what the cost structure would be for administering something that they didn't do themselves. So the intent being that they would fully recover their cost of administering the system. But they would have to demonstrate that to the Building Codes Division in terms of what their fee schedule was. That was the intent. I want to be real clear, there was no intent to try and unload additional costs on local governments. And in fact, part of the issue here was that it would be, in my mind, it would be better if the local governments could be fully staffed to meet all the turnaround processes, but there's a cost of doing that. If you staff up completely to meet that, and all of a sudden you don't have the applications coming in, you're stuck. You still got that staff on hand. That's why I refer to this relief valve. So, but even in that, if you're doing that, you still have a cost of administering the program. That's recognized. It would be my expectation that it would be more expensive to get your permission to go to a third-party private vendor to do this. That would be the expectation. But from the construction side, that cost is worthwhile because often your time and your turnaround is more important. It's more expensive to finance a waiting period and not get your work done and meet your client's needs than it is to pay a lower fee. That's usually not a big deal on the construction side.
Madam Chair.
Senator Fisher.
Not too long back, we had a little problem with a city building project very close to you. It's not in your district, but it's up in that direction. And that involved a situation where the city contracts out with the private company to do their inspections, and they had some particular feelings about certain portions of the code law and were hassling builders because they didn't like holding up their permits because they didn't like the fact that what they perceived as code problems, and they had to be read or forcefully told, that's not your job, get up to the legislature if you want to change something like that, or work through the system to change the code. You're not supposed to be out there hassling people. I mean, it's not about $100,000 situation in this particular project. And yeah, it seems to me there may have also been just a little bit of irritation that wasn't using a little bit more electrical products and perhaps using a little more labor and some things like that, which maybe they've been happy to provide. Is there any provisions in this bill to take care of something like that?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Fisher, that to an extent there is. One of the things we tried to build in or did build into the bill was the chief inspector concept that exists in the electrical now, and really that process in electrical was, if you've got a question, you can take it directly to the Building Code Agency, if I understand it, and get it clarified. And you're not changing the code by anything in this. The code's the code, but it's an interpretive power. If there is a dispute, the idea is that you'd be able to take that directly to the state and get an answer, and that answer ought to be then consistent in every jurisdiction in the state. That's part of the problem now that you have, and I think you probably heard it on 512, is in the metro area, you got 27 different jurisdictions doing the same thing, and, you know, rather than building officials from one community, you know, calling up Joe's office and saying, what is the code on this? We're not sure. Let's see if we can come to a common mind. They end up talking to each other, going back to the International Building Code Agency, and I think that's not right. My sense is that the state is really, it's the state code, and the state division is the source for the answer and the interpretation so that you have consistency. That would not answer your question. Is if they, if the contractor, the designer in that case, didn't like what the code was, they can provide, they can, there's a variance process or an alternative methods process is in there, but still you've got to get the interpretation from one place.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator, for being here. I have a couple questions. I'm still trying to get my hands on the problem here. You're saying in your statement that basically there's a problem with backlog as far as inspections. What's, in your mind, driving that? What is the rationale? And your solution is this. Is there some other reason or some other angle that we should be looking at with the local governments? Why is it that they're not able to meet some backlog?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Edwards, I think the issue really is one of workflow and staffing levels. I'll give you an example. In my area, the city of Eugene, we had a bit of a building boom over the last few years. At one point, commercial plans were up to 18 and 20 weeks to get a set of plans reviewed. That's a long time. If you come in, and you can miss an entire construction season on that. And it's just too much. You know, the question is, do you, and in fact, the city of Eugene did this. They hired a bunch of people, trained them, and brought them along. It takes a long time to bring somebody online as a qualified plans examiner. Well, they're at the point now where they're laying these people off because the construction boom has gone down. And so, you know, if it comes back up again, we'll face the same thing. That's why I really refer to 587 as sort of a relief valve. It's not to take the place of the local system. It's just to be able to level out the peaks and valleys a little bit.
And then your approach to this, then, I guess, to me, one of the key underpinnings is public safety of workers, safety of workers as well. So what in your mind in this bill provides that surety to you?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Edwards, I would think that a community, because it still, this doesn't take away the local system, the community and the city council or the county commission, whichever had the supervision, would still make a decision about what is their normal workflow and what is the goal, you know, what is the turnaround goal that they think is reasonable. We set out, in our example, some targets, but they could negotiate something different than their Central 35 plans with the state. And they would staff to that level. That would be my assumption, is that you'd decide that you wanted to have turnaround on residential plans in 2 weeks, and you would staff up so you know that they do that. And if you had a boom, you couldn't do that, then you would have the option as a local community of either adding staff yourself and trying to deal with, are you going to keep those on board or not after time, or finding an outside agent to contract with, or you want to do that, just saying we can't do it. You can go outside to licensed individuals the state has to deal with the overflow. But in each case, every applicant for building permit would come to that city or that county's building counter and say, you know, I've got a plan that needs to be reviewed just like they do today. And the building official would say, you know, accept that plan and say, we can do that in our turnaround time, or we don't think we can, and here are your options. I think it also provides a framework for, in a commercial setting, which I think is more likely, if someone's bringing in a new plant of some kind, they could come in and say, we have this need for turnaround, and the building official could negotiate on that of what was likely or the best way to deal with that. But I don't think it necessarily would affect public employees per se, you know, because I assume you staff to a certain level, you wouldn't want to be hiring people and then laying them off, you know, on a seasonal basis. That would make sense to me.
Okay. Now, my last question. I mean, you don't see an incentive in this bill for local governments to go the other way, which is to set up a contract and set up a list, register folks, and then basically get out of business and inspection, more or less. You're saying this is sort of to meet cycles in the work in the building industry?
Madam Chair, I don't think so. I don't think that incentive is there. There are the different systems that you have in the state now are the larger cities, which tend to be in the valley, are pretty much established professional operations. Some of the smaller cities, when you get out to, as well as in the valleys east of the mountains, their relationship now tends to be that they take responsibility on them and they contract with the private company to do it. And that's sort of the mode of operation now. And it has mainly to do with how much volume you're going to have. Regardless of if it's a private company or a public, body that's doing the work, you still got to staff to a certain level. The difference being a private operation, if you're talking about an engineering company, for example, they have other kinds of work that they do besides just reviewing permits, so there's a little more workflow control there. Public agencies really don't. You're either reviewing plans and doing inspections or you're not. And if you're not, because it's a fee-driven system, you're stuck. You have no way to shift that in terms of taxes other than onto your general fund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think if I heard you correctly in part of your testimony, Senator Breyer, you said that the state has done a poor job in standardizing the function in its role. If that is correct, why are we expanding the responsibility of that agency? If you have a situation where you say local governments already have the authority to contract privately, I guess I'm concerned that if we already have that ability to do that, and you're telling me that the agency has done a poor job in the past, why would we want to expand their scope of responsibility?
Madam Chair, Representative Winters, I believe the state hasn't done as good a job as they could, mainly because the legislature has never funded them to do the job that we chartered them to do. And the problem from the development community side is that you can be building exactly the same building in 27 different cities in this state and get 27 different answers and have to change your plans 27 different times because there's no consistency in the system. And I've heard that, for example, one that we all know well is the McDonald's Corporation. I've talked to people in my business in dealing with the designers from the McDonald's Corporation that say that Oregon is the hardest state to do business in because there's no consistency.
I've heard the same thing, but the consistency issue comes with standardized information, if you will, whether you're talking about OLCC and it has all these agents out in the field, or whether we're talking about the health division and at the local level, then the standardization actually comes from the state level, doesn't it?
I'm sure that's in the way. The standardization actually comes from the code. It's how you interpret the building code and where you look for interpretation. And the predominant system now is that the communities that are doing it do not look to the state as interpretive authority. Joe may disagree with me on that, but it's essentially they look to each other, and I think we need to focus that system in more. We have not developed a state system, frankly.
Just sort of three general questions. I'll just put them out there and then you can respond to them. One is the quality of the inspections. Will it maintain itself at the high level as it is? Will it be improved or diminished? The second is benefit to the consumer. Is the consumer protected from what these inspections are supposed to provide in the way of protection? They get good work done, or whatever he's having done. And the third is, what about the competitive nature of this? If you open it up to private inspections by licensed inspectors and a city program, can the city compete with the other? Will it have a detrimental effect? Will it, in effect, move us toward privatization of this whole thing, the inspection business? Can you respond to that?
Madam Chair, Senator Trolls, let me start from the last one first. Since the decision on how much the competitive environment is going to exist will rest with the city or county in any case, because the permits still go through them and they make that decision. I don't think it will have a direct effect on that. It's to the extent that the local governing body wants to let that happen. The control is really one of the licensing, and will we allow the building division at the state level the authority and the resources to go out and make sure that the system is working. That's one piece. The second piece is, since plans that are examined privately are still going to come back through the city, that's where they have to be turned in to get a permit. You do have a check there. They're going to look at them. From the city, there is some administrative cost, and they may end up doing the inspecting on it. Probably would be my guess. So you're going to have a check on that. My guess what would happen is, at least my experience in watching the industry in the southern end of the valley, is that everybody pretty much knows what everybody else is doing. And if there's the proverbial bad egg, that's going to get to Joe's office pretty quick. There's a problem that's out there.
You mentioned sweetheart deals. Is that a problem?
I don't think that it is now. The process is not wide enough to allow it to happen now. It's pretty much a contract. I guess the two places it could happen is you could have where you have cities that contract with a private company to do the work. And frankly, my perspective on that, where I've watched it, is that once the city does that, they don't really control it. I mean, frankly, the local city council in those cases really has no idea how the system operates. All they do is they contract for somebody to do it. Unless they get some complaints, they're going to let it go. I mean, that's just the way it is. Or unless Joe's shop comes in, and frankly, I don't think they have the ability to come in much now with their staffing level. So that hasn't evolved, to my knowledge, anywhere. The other side of the test of this is really, this is a practice that has existed for years in the manufactured housing industry, and it hasn't been a problem. And the quality, I think, has been there.
Consumers would agree with you?
I think Joe's probably the best one to answer that.
Senator Fisher?
Yeah. I just want to make a comment, because consistency has been a factor in times past. And I believe Mr. Brewer has worked to steady that out a little bit and maintain consistency, because down in our area we had a lot of problem with an inspector would come out and okay a certain portion of the project, and a subsequent later inspection would have a different person involved, and he would take exception to what had been allowed and recommended by the inspector prior to that. And I think, as I say, Mr. Brewer's gotten on top of this pretty well. At least the complaints have certainly gone out of sight now, and out of mind down in our area, and I appreciate that. I wanted you to know that I do appreciate that, and that consistency is something that contractors get extremely frustrated with, and even people doing home projects, they get pretty frustrated when one tells them one thing once, requires a different standard later on, and they're a long ways down the line in a construction project, and some of those things become extremely expensive and frustrating and time-consuming to go back and do redo. So thank you for the help, and consistency is a real need.
Thanks, Madam Chair. This does give new responsibilities to the state in terms of overseeing and creating consistency and overseeing this new kind of activity. How is the state paid for that new activity?
Madam Chair, Representative Ross, I wouldn't say it's new. I'd say it's expanded.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the system. There's a section here dealing with surcharge, which I think probably needs some additional work. We've heard about that. That's the way the state is paid now, is on a surcharge of any permit that's issued. And there's also the issue of putting a licensing program. The licensees would pay for that service as well.
So the licensees, these new private licensees, would pay a charge to the state for that part, and that would cover that expense. And then there's going to be an additional surcharge on local government to cover this?
Not on local governments, it's on the permits themselves when they're issued, so the permit applicant would be paying it.
We already are now up to 7% surcharge. It's going to go beyond that. This bill will require it to go beyond that.
For the record, Madam Chair, my name is Joe Brewer. I'm the administrator of the Building Codes Division. No, Representative Gloss, there's no additional surcharge. The surcharge that's spoken to in the bill really is obtained through addressing hourly inspections, which is a phenomenon that has really developed over the past several years, where a company, for instance, will buy an annual permit at a minimal cost and then charge, the building department will charge an hourly fee for inspection services. So this would apply that same surcharge that's charged for building permits on those hourly inspections that are done for construction projects.
I'm sure that's involved. Keep in mind that this is not it's an option for the community applicants. They don't have to go there. If they were to go in and the city, for example, City of Corbello says, I'm sorry, we can't meet this turnaround, we're just backlogged completely, you have these options, it's entirely permissible for the person to say, okay, I can live with that.
You said that you had some additional amendments and refinements that you wanted to take care of in the House Committee. Is that correct?
I think they're the dash fives. Is that right? Can you
just give us an example of what those might be?
Madam Chair, if I might, one of the examples that I might provide would be the dedicated fees collected by local building departments must be dedicated to the operation of the building department, but not segregated by specialty code. This is something that I think is very important to local government, so they can, in fact, have one enterprise fund for a building program and then be able to shift funds back and forth between specialty codes. The state is currently restricted to using only electrical money for electrical activities, only plumbing money for plumbing activities. A bill passed last session, according to the Department of Justice, imposes that same restriction on local building departments. And my understanding, and folks will speak to that later today, I'm sure, my understanding is that that's very restrictive and difficult for them to work with. So that's an example of one of the amendments. We've also, Madam Chair, should I provide my testimony? Thank you. We've worked, had numerous work sessions, as the Senator has indicated, trying to find consensus on these issues, and we've made good progress conceptually. As the Senator said, this bill will really provide an opportunity to give developers some predictability in the process. I think consumer protection, safety is what this is all about, and that's why the third-party licensing piece is included. The Senator spoke to the fact that currently third-party exists. Many municipalities contract with third-party providers and provide little or no supervision to that activity. So, in fact, you have a third-party provider acting independently. We believe that consistency around documents, or documentation, consistency around the administration of those activities will go a long way to helping. I can't help but reply to Representative Winter's comments through the chair to Representative Winter's. I believe the division is the place to find consistency. It was only in 1995 that we were given the responsibility for program oversight at the local level. Those rules didn't go into effect until July 1st, 1997. So we're really just beginning to see the effects of those program reviews and beginning to drive some consistency in that area. There are over 1,700 inspectors in our state, 130 jurisdictions. Consistency is a goal that we'll always strive for, and it'll always be elusive. It'll always be difficult to attain. A few of the consensus points that I believe we've reached: licensing and monitoring of all third-party providers, minimum state oversight. We're asking for one program tech to conduct those reviews, one clerical position to support those activities. But local governments may also provide operational oversight, as the Senator indicated. This is set up so that the third-party provider cannot provide both plan review and inspection. Third-party providers must carry errors and omissions insurance. Existing third-party providers at current service levels are not required to be licensed. They're simply certified. The important thing to remember is this is not a new concept. This concept is used in other areas of the country, and it's used successfully. An example of that is Alexandria, Virginia, where they were experiencing delays similar to what Senator Beyer spoke to by creating this cadre of third-party providers amongst professionals, architects, engineers. They found the system improved
because now architects and engineers were engaged in the code development process, engaged in training around code issues. It may come as a surprise, but that's not necessarily true today. We don't find many architectural firms, engineering firms, participating in code training, participating in the code development process. So it is a system that we're trying to develop. Local governments will retain primary authority for building program services. They establish a plan review and inspection timeline, as the Senator said. They approve, but there's nothing in this bill or in the amendments that would require a local building department to approve anything that does not comply with the code, and that's been a concern for some of the stakeholders involved in the process. Fees for the third-party services will be paid through the local building department. Another safety valve. I spoke to the dedicated funds issue. I believe the chief inspector concept that the Senator spoke to is critical. This allows a contractor who's engaged in a conflict at the local level to go to one source at the state level, get an interpretation, knowing that that's going to be the state's position on this issue. Currently, that individual, when they become engaged in a conflict at the local level, simply has to appeal to the board. That can take a long time to get on the board's agenda and get that issue addressed. Time is money on a construction project. And finally, you have state surcharge is expanded to apply to hourly activities. These responsibilities and duties simply have to be funded somehow. There has to be resource provided. And with a move to more and more activities conducted in an hourly sense, I believe it makes sense to charge the same surcharge there that you do in other permits. With that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Representative
Wood. Madam Chair, get to the fee, because I think Representative Ross raised it, and currently the surcharge is at 7%. And do I hear you correctly that the hourly charge is in addition to the 7%?
Through the chair to Representative Winters. No, the hourly charge is currently for inspection activities. The bill, as it is proposed to be amended, would simply apply that surcharge to those hourly activities. So those are permit dollars that are no longer in the system. They're being charged on an hourly basis. The proposal is simply to apply that same surcharge to those hourly charges as is applied to current building permits. If I might explain, a large company has construction going on almost on a continual basis. They have two choices. They can go out and buy a permit for each of those activities, pay their surcharge, or they can buy an annual permit and then pay an hourly fee to the building department. When that hourly fee is charged, the department does not necessarily collect that surcharge. We do in some cases. City of Portland's an example. Their total revenue to us for their hourly activities for 1 year was $1,400. So we're not talking about a large amount of money here. This is not an immense amount of revenue.
Who sets the charge for the private inspectors?
Through the chair to Representative Winters, that's set through the local process, and it's typically whatever is determined to be reasonable and necessary. The current process for raising fees or for establishing fees is local governments can set those fees, and then if no one complains, they simply are established at that level. If we receive complaints, then we go in and conduct a hearing and determine whether those fees are reasonable or necessary.
So the state will have no involvement in setting those fees and the contractual relationship with the third party?
Through the chair, Representative Winters, the bill as currently written, the Ingram-Gross version, includes that language. We've experienced some difficulty this session getting the language we expect out of legislative council. They're doing the best they can, and obviously we're not communicating effectively, but we've been through a couple of iterations now, and we're still not there. The Ingram-Gross version needs to be amended again.
But the intent is that it's set locally at the municipality level and not at the state level. Is that correct?
Through the chair to Representative Winters, if we're speaking of the fee charged by the third-party provider, that's established by the third-party provider and their customer. The market drives that. The hourly charge for inspections conducted under implant or master permit programs, which is what the surcharge will be charged against, that's
established at the local level.
Senator Charles?
Just a couple questions. One about the A5 amendment. Why didn't the Senate committee put the A5 in the bill?
Madam Chair, Representative Senator Cho, I'm going to defer to Senator Byers.
We just need to move it faster, and that's the problem.
Madam Chair, so we talked about these, but we were trying to, recognizing where we were in the session a month ago, decided to move it ahead and agreed that we would support making these changes on the House side.
Everyone rejected it.
No.
The other question has to do with this chief inspector who's going to handle appeals rather than the board. Is that new?
Madam Chair, Senator Troke, it's not new in some specialty code areas. The electrical code has a chief. It would be new in the structural and mechanical area as well as some other areas. It would establish that chief's position for each of the specialty codes, which is really a level of appeal just below the state board.
Okay. Can you appeal that decision to the board?
Madam Chair, Senator Crow, yeah. And then you can appeal the board's decision, I believe, to court.
That's another step, but hopefully it will handle a lot of those things in terms of differences over interpretation quickly.
Madam Chair, Senator Crow, we found that to be true in the electrical area and the plumbing area. Typically, when a contractor or the building official get the state's position, then they drive that to some kind of level of agreement before it's appealed to the board more often.
Joe, we see a figure of $147,106, and it's for a part-time FTE, one position. Is that going to be enough to implement this program?
Madam Chair, we believe there may be as many as 25 service providers initially. We believe that one position is enough to monitor that number of providers on a fairly regular basis, perhaps getting to each provider once per year. Now, would we prefer to see stronger, more intense oversight? Perhaps. But at the same time, this is a new concept, and we have not tried it. So, We have experienced some of the effects in the modular construction area, as Senator Beyer indicated. We started out there with great difficulty. It was very contentious. We were auditing 100% of the third party's activities. That was far too much. We backed off to 10%, and we believe that's a reasonable level at this point in time. So if we could strike something like that with these third party providers, we think we could do an adequate job.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gorton?
Thank you very much. The City of Portland is opposed to the bill. What is your understanding of their opposition?
Through the chair to Senator Gordley, the City of Portland has been at the table for a number of the work group activities. My understanding was that they were conceptually, had reached consensus with us. I believe most of the disagreement is over the language currently reflected in the bill. I believe we can get the amendments drafted that everyone agrees to, that there will be consensus. But again, I'd like to let the City of Portland speak to that, I suppose.
I hope that we will be hearing from them, but I wanted to hear your perspective on where you are.
Will the amendments change the fiscal?
I'm sure no.
It has no impact. So I'm a little reticent because I feel like we're doing a fiscal on a bill that's not quite developed yet.
Madam Chair, the fiscal impact before you is was reflected in, I believe, the dash threes, and really what we've been talking about since then are concepts, not necessarily more work activities. The licensing system, monitoring of those the third party providers has been a part of the bill since then.
Madam Chair, to address part of that and Senator Gordon's, one of the concerns early on had to do with the turnaround time on commercial permits, and frankly, Portland is a bit different than the rest, and the bit different is the number of tall buildings that they build it that are probably, they are a lot more complex than other areas. They were concerned about that, and we had some language in the Dan Gross that deals with complex commercial projects. Our intent was to allow that to be changed, and frankly, part of the change that you've seen in the bill was It started out with more of the responsibility on the department to develop administrative roles. That was more expensive. And through some of the process, what we're doing is shifted that back to an encouragement of the local governments as they submit their Senate Bill 35 plans, that they would spell those things out. At least that's the concept that we're working on, which frankly lessens the impact on Joe's shop to develop those and puts them in more of a review standpoint. I think the other side of that one from the local government is allows them to customize what they want to do and recognizes the differences between, you know, a Portland and a Bandon.
How do you keep consistency then in the process?
It mainly deals with the turnaround times, and I think it doesn't deal with or doesn't address the consistency of the code so much as how you handle the permitting process. Maybe it's worthwhile to do more, you know, faster turnaround in a smaller area, and you don't have the same kinds of complex that you have someplace else. So I think it allows that to happen.
Madam Chair, the current system was developed with the municipality's participation, and our understanding was that this was more desirable as an approach because one size cannot fit all. Things are very much different in Bandon than they are in the City of Portland.
You said that you thought that the sweetheart deal wasn't a problem. What is the disincentive or the barrier that keeps companies from looking at the list and as they negotiate with someone, the unspoken agreement is I'll pay you more if you'll kind of go easy on this job and not look too close at details. What's the disincentive for that?
Thank you. Madam Chair, Representative Ross, my belief is that disincentive is simply that the local jurisdiction will review those plans. They will do a cursory review. They will perform the inspections. The third-party provider cannot provide both the inspection and the plan review. And in addition to that, you have, I hope, active state oversight. One of the phenomena that we've observed in the Senate Bill 35 exercise is that the more the program is known, the more complaints we get. So my belief is that if a contractor or a builder saw someone getting away with things they knew they weren't according to code, they'd report it, and we would investigate.
Madam Chair, Richard Ross, one other thing I should note is if you look at the penalty section in there, there's a fairly hefty penalty that's there for people who intentionally violate. There's a pretty heavy one in there.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, we have about 5 minutes. It's going to take longer than 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. Mr. Broner, do you want to come on up? Can you do your testimony in 5 minutes?
Well, we're
I'll
see you
later.
Ralph, you have 5 minutes.
No way.
I'm
taking
bets.
5 minutes.
No way. I get $5.
Did you really say 5 minutes?
We have session at 10 o'clock.
Well, don't count my time until I lay my notes out. Please. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ralph Groner, and I'm speaking in opposition to the current Senate Bill 587, whatever that is, and I'll explain that comment to you. I'd like to say the firefighters join AFSCME in opposition to this bill, as does the OPEU and the AFL-CIO, so it is a nasty bill to labor. Let me first hit that it's not really a labor issue so much to me personally, and I guess I've really been the lead of opposing this bill, in that I see it as an anti-consumer bill. I can't answer all the questions Lee raised in 5 minutes, so I'll try to sort through them because I was writing down his comments. First, I questioned the cost. I went to Adrian for the fiscal on the original bill. Let me make sure that everybody on this committee is aware that when 587 went through in front of Lee Byer's committee, that wasn't the bill we heard. We were given 587-3, and we were told we're passing the bill out. Not one of us in this room had an opportunity to testify on the actual amendment that passed out. If you understand a little frustration, it's because we've never had a public hearing on 587, and it's a substantive issue coming in front of Ways and Means. I totally agree with whomever has some concern with that, so we're venting some of that today. let me just say that, so this question of A5 we're up to, and I'm told by Joe there's an A6 coming in. Let me clarify, I've been on the work group of Pinnabill 35, 4 years, and I've also been on this work group. I consider each and every one of these individuals a friend of mine. So if we have disagreements on this, it really isn't so much between my union as it is having 8 years experience at the local level dealing with these issues, and also land use practices, water, sewer, so forth, highway, transportation collectively, and fire issues, fire safety. To me, the cost of this has been understated by Joe, and I hope we're still friends when I'm done, because frankly, in the bill, we're looking at 3 new inspectors. As he stated, we have chief inspectors in electrical and plumbing, but now we're adding those to structural, we're adding those to mechanical, and he said other. My understanding would be that it'd be manufactured housing, and when asked how we're going to fund that, we'll simply move people into those positions, but the people that would be moved, I need to state to somebody that will listen in this building, need to be replaced to do the job they're currently doing. I also have had probably the primary concern I've had is the consumer in this legislature, I feel, has a little bit of a caveat emptor kind of session going on inadvertently. I don't think any one person means that. But the truth of the matter is, if you're going to move to chief inspectors, let me finish that on the fiscal, the cost isn't what was just stated to you. And I don't think the cost has really been washed out so that we clearly understand it. And we've had a couple other bills passed through this committee that do have cost to the builder and the developer when buying a permit. And that cost is going to be reflected in the cost of new buildings or commercial. I'd also like to say that the liability question is of concern currently in this bill. The third-party inspector approves a building permit. The local government entity has no choice but to go ahead and approve that. And even though they say in the bill they've taken the liability away, those of you who are lawyers, if none, that's fine. My background in law shows me that it doesn't make a tinker's stamp in front of the judge if you, in fact, knew that there was a flaw in any one of those conditions of that permit and you let it out of your city or your county, you're going to have liability, especially if there's somebody who gets hurt in a fire or somebody who gets hurt because of inadequate oversight. So I also like to say this potentially does impact labor and our collective bargaining agreements. Most cities and counties in Oregon are represented by 2 unions. We're more at the local level. We're, as asked me, the union I work for. Currently, if you're going to third party, you don't just do that. You have to recognize our contracts to deal with that issue that we've negotiated at the local. The fiscal, the local government has. If I'm only going to get 5 minutes, the bottom line is I have to say I think this whole thing has been rather Pollyannish. And I think that we need an interim committee. I think we need a balance to look at this whole thing so that we simply understand it. On the one end, it's the need of the builder and the developer, and I've never been one who is against builders or developers because that helps our economy, and I truly understand that. In the middle are the state agency and their needs, cities, counties. And then over here is the consumer. And all I'm asking for is that scale, that balance, not be tipped too far toward development interest at the expense of the consumer. Because I believe the overview of third party or private parties ought to be the responsibility of the local city and county, not the oversight of the state. Now, they're going to make intermittent overview of the third party inspectors by the state. For me, on behalf of the consumer at this table, that's not good enough. It's not going to get it, folks. And the fact of the matter is the day will come, I believe, we're sorry if we allowed this bill out when we're told new amendments are going to be worked out. We were told in that committee new amendments would be worked out. We didn't get to testify on the -3. Now all of a sudden we have -4, -5, and we're told -6, and we're sitting here in front of a committee that's passed bills out, I won't say their numbers, that have already had an impact on the consumer. So at the very heart of this, I hope you'll look at the balance. I have a number of issues. I have testimony written, but I'm probably over the 5 minutes. asked me legitimately, and with some sense of concern, opposes 587 as it currently is written. I have to say the work committee did take care of some of our concerns, but we have a long way to go. And this is an important issue, not only the development interest. You know, one of the things that bothers me about the time limits, by the way, I want to throw this at you, the real world. 10-day on simple housing to be determined by a state building code division. By the way, I'm not being nasty. They're my members also. I also have the cities and counties in each of the cities I look at you where you live are the building inspectors. But the fact of the matter is they're going to make that determination, and then we have 15 days on so-called simple, quote, commercial. What they don't take into account are the things we faced as commissioners and city council, and that is the fact that we have land use laws, and we have to deal with schools and crowded conditions, particularly under Measure 5 and 50. We have to, although the legislature, not you folks, but has changed that in recent years. We're not even allowed to look at that, but I certainly would. Transportation, some of our roads are basically, and we have to look at sewer capability, highway capability, school capability, and these things don't happen necessarily in just 5-10 days because you all want that to happen. I'm being right up front with you. If we have a major subdivision that's going to overcrowd a local school district, then we need to deal with that as local city council, and that has to go through planning. There's our water sewer system, i.e. Tigard, Wilsonville, inadequate, overdeveloped, no water, going to the Willamette, I'd move out. So, at any rate, thank you. We would hope that you'd move this to an interim committee, and if there's pressure to move this on to the committee, I don't know how they'll pass it on to the Senate. Quite frankly, the battle will be on the floor of the House, and from what I've seen, they don't have the votes on the floor of the House, to be blunt with you all. Anyway, the work we've done is over here, primarily because we felt that we weren't allowed to testify on the Senate side. So now we finally get in front of at least a few senators, and the battle will be on the House side. I have nothing more to say. Thank you for the 6 minutes, and thank you to everybody here who's been nice to me on the work group.
We will be bringing this issue back. Appreciate your testimony. With that, we are adjourned.